sixth case of the morning is Donaldson v. Monsanto. Mr. Siegel.
Good morning. May it please the court. I am Norman Siegel. Together with my colleagues, we represent certified classes of pensioners of the defendants' appellees in this case, consisting of Monsanto, Solutia, and Pharmacia. We ask the court today to reverse and vacate the trial court, which granted summary judgment in favor of the defendants, and instead enter judgment on behalf of plaintiffs and remand the case for further findings related to damages. The question for the court this morning is whether defendants' cash balance defined benefit plan violates ERISA's prohibition against reducing the rate of benefit accrual because of the attainment of any age. Here, the rate of benefit accrual was ceased altogether in violation of ERISA 204B1H. The terms of this plan are clearly defined throughout Section 3.1, which begins on the Joint Appendix of page 13. And this is a cash balance plan with two notional accounts. One is a cash balance account, which increases three ways. One, through contribution credits. Second, transition credits. And the third component of this cash balance account component of the plan increases by interest credits calculated at the 30-year Treasury rate, and importantly, calculated through the participant's annuity starting date. And that's defined in 6.3 on page 35 of the Joint Appendix. That's the interest credits specifically on the cash balance account. Then there's another account, and that is the prior plan account, which is specifically at issue in this case. That consists of two ways that the balance increases. The first way is through pay credits. 4% of the prior plan account balance increases by pay credits. So long as the employee remains employed, he or she is entitled to that 4%. The employee is also entitled to 8.5% on those pay credits and 8.5% on the balance, but only until age 55 by the express terms of the plan. Our claim is that that express ceasing of interest credits on both the pay credit, which was not discussed by the district court at all, but also on the balance, violates ERISA's prohibition on ceasing benefit accrual because of the attainment of age. And we think the district court got it part right when it began its discussion on page 7 of the plan, because in fact also found that the plan's terms were unambiguous, and indeed found in section 6.2D, which contains the interest credit definition for the prior plan account, that they are, in fact, on its face, an accrued benefit to which a participant is entitled when he reaches normal retirement age. The district court concludes initially that under the plain terms of the plan, then, the participant's accrual of interest credit ceases because the participant attained age 55 and therefore violates ERISA's prohibition on ceasing benefit accrual because of the attainment of any age, citing Berger and 96.8 of the Internal Revenue Notice. And this is where we believe the district court got off track, because after finding that the plain language of the plan violated ERISA, the court veered off into a discussion of whether there was extrinsic ambiguity in the plan, and of course ultimately found that there was in granting defendant's summary judgment. This court, of course, reviews the decision de novo and should start with an analysis of whether the 8.5% interest credits, again, both on the pay credit not discussed by the district court but also on the whole balance, constitute benefit accruals. And we believe that Cooper deals with this expressly and finally. In Cooper, this court said, again, with respect to a cash balance plan, that benefit accruals are additions to the participant's hypothetical account for the plan year. Like all cash balance plans, these are notional accounts. Actual dollars don't flow. It's an accounting mechanism. And what Cooper said is, if you increase that accounting mechanism for a notional account, that is an increase in benefit accrual, period. Of course, the court in Cooper was facing a different type of case, one claiming that all cash benefit plans were illegal because the time value of money disfavored older workers. But the principles of Cooper apply squarely here. That is, benefit accrual means additions to these notational accounts. What Cooper was also clear about distinguishing was the concept of accrued benefit, which is an annual benefit calculated at normal retirement age. And here's where we think the district court went wrong, and indeed defendants' arguments on appeal are incorrect. Benefit accrual does not equal accrued benefit. The question that Cooper poses with respect to analyzing whether something is a benefit accrual for purposes of the discrimination provision in 204B1H is, again, whether it affects the notional account, and even defendants acknowledge that it, in fact, does. Cooper says all sorts of things go wrong when you treat accrued benefit as benefit accrual, and indeed, we don't think the rule should change for this case. It's also important to note, of course, that 204B1H speaks about benefit accruals, not accrued benefit. And indeed, there is no question that a benefit accrual in terms of the change to notational account, both with the effect on the pay credits, the 4% under the prior plan account, as well as the balance, constitute such benefit accruals for 204B1H purposes. Now, defendants spend an awful lot of their brief trying to argue these are not benefit accruals. It then washes away much of that argument, or all of it, on page 24 in a footnote on note 7. It says, measuring inputs to benefit accruals may be correct for a typical cash balance plan, but the prior plan account is not a typical cash balance account. It's our contention that there's absolutely nothing within the plain wording of this plan that would suggest this is something other than a cash balance account under a cash balance plan, the prior plan account, that is. In fact, when this court in Berger was faced with a similar argument by Xerox in a cash balance account context, cash balance plan context, Xerox tried to argue that it wasn't necessary to project interest credits through normal retirement age because it was a hybrid account. And what the court said in Berger was, there's no such thing in the context of a cash balance plan under ERISA. The opinion specifically says at page 763, insert illegal for a hybrid. And so, too, we think here, when the defendants say that the prior plan account is not typical, insert illegal for not typical. Based on Cooper, then, and defendants' admission that these notional accounts do, in fact, increase, we think there is little question that the 8.5%, both on the pay credits and the prior plan account balance, constitute benefit accruals. The next step under 204B1H, it says you cannot cease benefit accruals because the attainment of an age. And we think that is also clear on its face. What the plan says under 6.2D is that interest credits cease when the participant attains age 55. It uses the same root of the word attainment. So again, the plain language, using the word attain in the plan language, we think is clear that attainment of any age in 204B1H is satisfied here. Because this is a facial violation of ERISA, where the age-based provision is expressed in the document, nothing more needs to be shown. There is no requirement that an illicit motive must be shown. And in fact, this was recently emphasized by the Supreme Court in Kentucky Retirement when it said that its opinion, in fact, upholds the longstanding doctrine that if there is an express provision that ceases a benefit because of the attainment of any age, it will fail ERISA's discrimination provision, 204B1H. That is the case. That's the beginning, middle, and end. You have a facially defective provision in 6.2D of the plan, which provides that interest credits cease because of the attainment of an age. Everything else that the defendants argue here is a smokescreen. And the reason we know it's a smokescreen is because they have failed to account for the pay credits that are part of the prior plan account. The district court didn't take it up in its opinion, and there's two paragraphs dedicated to it in defendant's briefing. But you can't ignore the pay credits on the prior plan account. These are pay credits that continue to increase at 4%, but only until, and in violation of ERISA, only until the participant reaches age 55. They use an example of Mary Doe throughout their papers, and they use this in the district court as well. Mary Doe is representative of no one. And the reason we know Mary Doe is representative of no one is because she is identified as an age 50 employee who is employed on January 1st, 1997, when the plan converts to a cash balance plan, but then doesn't work. And that's what we think is the problem with Mary Doe. The defendants need to identify Mary Doe as somebody who doesn't work a day after the plan is effective because they can't handle the pay credits that Mary Doe would enjoy at 4% following her first day of work in the new plan year, January 1st, 1997. The other argument that defendants have made throughout their papers is that this isn't really a benefit accrual that ceases because of the attainment of an age. It's an early retirement benefit. Now, what you will find in the definition sections of the plan is no early retirement benefit. It is not defined in the definitional section of the plan. Accounts are defined as, in 3.1 on page 13 of the appendix, a participant's cash balance account and prior plan account. The prior plan account, which defendants claim is in fact something different, an early retirement discount formula, the prior plan account is defined as the hypothetical account established pursuant to section 6.2. There's nothing in there about a retirement discount formula. We also know that
on your plan, the plan in question, you can retire at 55, right?
I'm sorry?
You can take diminished benefits at 55 into this plan, can't you?
Well, there's the answer is no. There's no retirement status. There's no special retirement status.
You leave you at 55, you have no benefits?
You have benefits.
Are they reduced?
I'm sorry?
Are they reduced?
They are. It depends. You get the benefit of the sum of what's in your cash balance account and your prior plan account. We argue the failure here is to not attributing those benefits to age 65. So they're reduced because the plan's illegal. But you can there is a mechanism to take a benefit, sure. But importantly, there's no special pension status here, and there's no formula that attaches to an early retirement benefit. And in fact, we know that because there's a contemporaneous document that defendants provided to the IRS. Their Form 5300, which sought tax treatment for this plan, specifically asks early retirement benefit formula is, and they respond, and this is page 217 of the joint appendix, no early retirement benefit formula. And this is not extrinsic evidence because it's entirely consistent with the plan. There's no early retirement discount formula. And this is the exact reason that Atkins is an opposite to this case. In Atkins, it is clear because they talk about 204B1HV, which defendants also raise in their brief. 204B1HV and Atkins deal with the same issue, and that is how to deal with this concept of restoring an early benefit discount. But, again, there is no early benefit discount defined in this plan. And there was expressly in Atkins. You can start to components of the definition on page 1200 of the plan. Atkins is also not a cash balance plan. And why is that important? That's important because Berger and Cooper tell us that cash balance plans are unique in this respect in that they have these notional accounts, unlike a typical defined benefit plan, and therefore are subject to the requirements of Berger and 96-8. So again, there's no pension status here. We also know, unlike plans that do have an early retirement benefit formula that freeze a plan when they convert to a cash balance plan, this plan is not frozen. Why? Again, because we have the pay credit. And because the pay credit is there, the prior plan account continues to have benefit accrual at 4% as long as the employee is working, but once they hit age 55, that cuts off.
Mr. Siegel, you make the point in distinguishing Atkins that it doesn't contain a the retirement plan here doesn't contain a service cap.
That's right.
Why does that distinction matter?
Well, because in Atkins they were saying there was a combination of two things going on there. One was the express early retirement pension, but also the 25-year service cap. Once these pilots hit a service cap, they had a defined part of the plan, not based on age, but based on pension status. What is that pension status? You've hit your service cap. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. If there are no questions, I will reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Blocker?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Mark Blocker. I'm speaking on behalf of all of the appellees today. The rest of the counsel with whom I've been working are at counsel table. I want to address three main issues today, given what Mr. Siegel said. First, I want to address the issue about whether the PPA interest credits are benefit accruals that cease because of age. Second, I'm going to address the arguments that Mr. Siegel just made about the 4% pay credits, and I'll explain to you why the pay credits don't change the outcome here. They're subject to the same analysis that the rest of the balance in the PPA is subject to. And third, I'm going to address Mr. Siegel's arguments about extrinsic evidence. And the bottom line on that is, I'll explain to you in a minute, those are really a red herring because Your Honors can rule for the defendants on the plain language of the plan. Before I get to that, though, I wanted to address Judge Flom's question because you asked, and I didn't think really got an answer, you know, can you retire at 55? And the answer is yes, you can retire at 55. And do you get a full benefit at age 55? Yes. You get a full unreduced benefit. Under the PPA, you get everything that you were entitled to under the prior plan in full at age 55 rather than age 65, which is what used to happen under the predecessor plan. So I hope that answers your question. First point I'm going to talk about related to that, though, is I'm going to address whether the 8.5% credits are benefit accruals that cease because of age. To win on this point, the plaintiffs have to prove two things. They have to prove, A, that these are benefit accruals, and, B, that they cease because of age. So I'll start off with whether these are benefit accruals. And the simple answer to that, Your Honors, is that the 8.5% credits are not benefit accruals because they are not new benefits. In Cooper, that's the case that Mr. Siegel made a big deal of. This court held that benefit accruals are, quote, additions to the pot. And the 8.5% credits are not additions to the pot. A participant who gets an 8.5% credit isn't earning anything new. The benefit that they were entitled to under the PPA was set in stone on 1/1/97, and the 8.5% credits are merely a device to allow the participants to take that benefit earlier than age 55. Now, plaintiffs say that the credits change the stated account balance, and that makes them benefit accruals, that alone. But that ignores the fact, Your Honor, that these are benefits that were already earned. These are everything that's in the PPA, with the exception of the 4% credits, which I'll get to, represents benefits employees earned under the old plan. It makes absolutely no sense to call benefits that have already been earned by employees benefit accruals. Now let me move to the because of age side of the equation, Your Honor. These credits don't cease because of age. The argument that plaintiffs are making here is the exact one that was rejected by the court in the Atkins case, the Eighth Circuit decision in Atkins. And the lesson of Atkins is this. If a plan has credits that are reversing out an early retirement discount, it doesn't violate ERISA's age discrimination provision if the credits are stopped once the discount is fully reversed. As the court made clear in Atkins, in those circumstances, the credits cease not because of age, but because the early retirement discount has been fully exhausted at that point. Judge Flom, you also asked Mr. Siegel whether it made any difference that there were service caps in the Atkins case. It really makes absolutely no difference to the analysis here. In some ways, it supports the analysis because, remember, in this plan, in the prior plan account, we're taking benefits that were earned under another plan and just sticking them into an account. That benefit was set in stone on 1/1/97. So in the same way that somebody earning us couldn't earn additional credit in Atkins after the 25 years, no one earns anything new in the prior plan account. The bottom line, though, is that the circumstances of Atkins with respect to the plan are exactly the circumstances you have in this case. The 8.5% credits restore an initial discounting that was taken from the prior plan account for participants who are under age 55. And once that discounting is reversed, the 8.5% credits stop. And like in Atkins, the credits, therefore, do not cease because of age. Now, in their briefs, and again today, plaintiffs have all sorts of factual distinctions. Judge Flom, you identified the one about service caps, but you heard Mr. Siegel articulate what is really their main and only distinction of the Atkins case, which is that it involved a cash balance plan, and in the Atkins case, we were talking about what people normally think of as a traditional defined benefit plan. It was one that calculated benefits based on final average pay. That is the proverbial distinction without a difference, Your Honor. Both plans are defined benefit plans, and the same age discrimination rules apply to both plans. Whether it's a cash balance plan or a final average pay plan, the same age discrimination rules under ERISA apply. If the plan in Atkins didn't violate ERISA, there is absolutely no reason that the outcome should be different here. Now let me address the 4% pay credits. Mr. Siegel pointed out that the district court really didn't address this point. There's a good reason for that. The plaintiffs really didn't do much with this in the district court, so Judge Gilbert really can't be faulted. They've made much, much more of this on appeal than they did in the district court. Now, before I tell you why I think they don't matter, let me point out, and Mr. Siegel alluded to the fact, that we anticipated the plaintiffs would make this argument, and it is addressed on page 29 and 30 of our brief. And I'm mentioning that because on pages 29 and 30, we actually have a mathematical example that will show you why the pay credits don't change the outcome in this case. If you look in plaintiff's reply brief, you won't see any response to that, and you're not going to hear one from Mr. Siegel today because there isn't a good response. But here's how the pay credits work and why they don't make any difference to the outcome here. And I am going to use the Mary Doe chart, which is on page 21 of our brief, to make this point. You can think of the plan, when a participant gets a 4% pay credit, you can think of it as adding 4% to Mary Doe's accrued benefit right away. So if you look at the chart on page 21 of our brief, you'll see in column C and in column D, that her accrued benefit is $125,000. If she is going to get a 4% pay credit, she is going to get $5,000 in additional benefits when she reaches age 55. It's 4% of $125,000. But if she wants it now, she can get it now, but she can only get it on a discounted basis if she's under 55. So like the rest of her account balance, which is discounted by 8.5%, you can think of that $5,000 increment as also available to her at earlier ages, but discounted by 8.5% until she reaches age 55. And like the rest of her account balance, 8.5% interest credits are added until you get back to the full $5,000 that she was entitled to take in full at age 55. What that means, Your Honor, is the 8.5% credits on the 4% pay credits are not benefit accruals. They don't change her accrued benefit. These are just credits that restore a discount. The simple and bottom line is that no interest is ever paid on those 4% credits. Participants get a straight 4% regardless of the age, and that is not age discrimination. Third point I wanted to address concerns extrinsic evidence. And as I said at the very outset, these arguments are really a red herring. Plaintiffs say that our arguments about the restoration of the discount rely on extrinsic evidence which shouldn't have been considered by the district court. And by extrinsic evidence, Your Honor, so we know what we're talking about here, they mean the old plan and communications that were made to participants about the new plan. But the premise of this argument is wrong. You can determine the function of the 8.5% credits by looking only at the terms of the plan itself. You never need to reach any extrinsic evidence. There are two provisions in the plan that make absolutely clear how the 8.5% credits work. That is Section 6.2B, as in boy, and Section 6.2D, as in dog. And these provisions are located on page 32 and 34 of the joint appendix. These two provisions work together, and plaintiffs only want you to look at one of them. They only want you to look at Section 6.2D. And, in fact, when Mr. Siegel was making his argument, he referred only to Section 6.2D without ever referring to Section 6.2B. But let me explain to you how they work together and why you don't need to reach any extrinsic evidence. Section 6.2B is the provision of the plan that creates the opening account balance. And it says that the opening account balance, whatever was earned under the old plan, will be paid in full at age 55, but discounted for participants under age 55 by 8.5%. And then in Section 6.2D, you'll find the mirror image, which talks about how that balance is built back up. Section 6.2D says that then you add 8.5% interest credits all the way back up to 55 until the full balance is restored. So the 8.5% credits are a mechanism for the participants to take their accounts early, but once you get to age 55, they're entitled to the full balance, and that's what the 8.5% credits do. So you don't need to reach any extrinsic evidence to rule in our favor in this case. And plaintiff's only response to Section 6.2B and Section 6.2D is to say that, well, you shouldn't read them together because there's no cross-reference from one to the other. In other words, Section 6.2D doesn't say, oh, go back and look at Section 6.2B and vice versa. But the goal of contract interpretation is to read the contract as a whole, not to read the provisions in isolation, which is exactly what the plaintiffs are asking this court to do. They want you to look only at Section 6.2D and treat it as if Section 6.2B is in boy and the plan never existed. So, Your Honors, you do not need to reach any extrinsic evidence to rule in favor of the defendants. But even if the court were to conclude that those provisions alone were not sufficient to tell you what the operation is of the 8.5% credits, the district court was plainly correct under this court's decision in Matthews versus Sears to resolve an extrinsic ambiguity as to the meaning of the term interest credits in Section 6.2D of the plan by looking at extrinsic evidence. And, Your Honors, as you can see from the record, there is voluminous objective evidence indicating what the function is of the 8.5% credits is, and all of that evidence says the same thing, which is it was simply to restore a discount. You can look at the documents that are contained in our supplemental appendix. A perfect example I would submit is at SA 41. It's a presentation from 1996 that was given to employees before the new plan was put in place. And part of the presentation is entitled, Why Prior Plan Account Interest Credits Stop at Age 55? And it explains that the credits stop at age 55 because your opening account balance has been built back up to its full value at age 55. You will also find on Supplemental Appendix page 15 another perfect example of the explanation that this is a reversal of a discount. But again, Your Honor, while we think it was wholly appropriate for the district court to consider extrinsic evidence in reaching its decision, there is no question you do not need to do so in order to rule in our favor. Whether you accept plaintiff's extrinsic ambiguity evidence or their argument or not, we win either way. Your Honors, I know we're into the lunch hour, close to the lunch hour. I'm happy to address any further questions Your Honor may have, but if there are no other questions, I will sit down and simply ask the court to affirm the district court judgment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Glasser. Mr. Siegel.
Thank you. Just a few closing points. The plan is plain on its face. The concept of extrinsic evidence, if you read the district court's opinion, it found it was plain on its face. The pay credit that defendants tried, Mr. Blocker tried to explain away here, completely flies in the face of not only this court's jurisprudence, but every court to have considered what exactly a benefit accrual is. There is no way that this court can escape addressing the pay credit, and in fact, a finding that it is a new benefit accrual. Their argument would make some sense if you believed everything else, that this was some effort to restore an early retirement discount. If you accepted their extrinsic evidence, rejected the plain language of the plan, but it still does not answer the pay credit. The mathematical tautology that's in the defendant's brief at pages 29 to 30 simply adds 2 plus 3 gets 5 and then subtracts 2 and shows you how you got 3. The fact that each of those credits, each of those pay credits are earned on a monthly basis and added to the account are absolutely new benefit accruals for which the 8.5% must be calculated under Berger, under 96-8, through normal retirement age to calculate the accrued benefit, and indeed should be calculated based on until the employee takes their pension benefit, just as the interest credit defined for the cash balance account. And indeed, the court needs to look no further than Section 6.2C, which talks about the cash 6.2D, my apologies, 6.2D and 6.3D, which both use the term interest credits. Our trouble with defendant's argument, and this is a proximity argument, you should look at 6.2B and 6.2D because they're so close together in the plan. 6.2B is on the appendix at 32, the joint appendix at 32, 6.2D is on the joint appendix at 34. 6.2D is equally close to 6.3D, which also uses the term interest credits in the way intended by ERISA. That is, they are calculated through either, the definition is through the pension date, or alternatively, if you're calculating an accrued benefit, through normal retirement age. They do not cut off at age 55. So you cannot look at the plain language of this plan and conclude anything other than it fails ERISA's 204B1H test. Finally, Green versus UPS, the idea of extrinsic evidence, it's a very narrow doctrine, one that should not be used unless there is an absurd result. We think Green itself, which provided a small local union power over all the Teamsters of UPS, the court here did not find that that was sufficiently absurd to allow an extrinsic evidence, and the court shouldn't do it here. And again, the extrinsic evidence isn't all beneficial to the defendants. The Form 5300, which you did not hear Mr. Blocker talk about, is, again, an express contemporaneous document which says what their intent was, that there's no early retirement discount formula, period.
Do you want us to consider that one?
It's consistent with the contract, so it's not extrinsic evidence, at least under this court's decision and how it applies common law contract interpretation. I see that my time is up. I'll ask the court to reverse the district court and enter judgment in favor of the plaintiffs.
Thank you, Mr. Shango. Mr. Blocker. Thanks to all counsel, and the case is taken under advisement. Court will stand in recess.